From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what might come from the protest by homeless activists in Kalamazoo? We talk with the head of the city's only emergency overnight shelter.
As people come to us, at least, that we can help to redevelop the want to inside of them and show them that they do have a certain amount of power. They do have options.
Michigan's Libertarian Party with a plan to reduce teen pregnancy.
We're going to provide actual direct payments to young girls who are willing to commit themselves to a plan year by year to hold off having children until they're 23 years of age, where they're going to be in a better position to be a successful parent.
And the Spanish flu outbreak in Michigan.
Bodies were being stacked like cordwood. And that shows you how many people were dying and how rapidly they were dying.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. And now the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is a new development in the ongoing protest by Kalamazoo's homeless community. Protesters have camped out downtown in Bronson Park over the past month to highlight their complaints the city isn't doing enough to address homelessness. Well, now the city is ordering the protesters to break up the camp and be out of the park by 7 tonight. Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman is at Bronson Park, and he's with us now via Skype. Bryce, city officials say if you're not out of the park by 7 this evening, you could be arrested. How are the protesters reacting?
Well, many of the protesters that I've talked to are prepared to be arrested. Many of them have been informed by group officials to not ever engage with police, not to say anything to them, just to be peaceful. And if they do attempt to arrest them, to just go willingly and then fight the rest later.
What are they saying to you, Bryce?
A lot of them are upset. They think that the city is using money as a way to kick homeless people away from where they've been living. A lot of them feel that instead of arresting homeless people, they should be asking what more can be done to actually address the problem. The city commission actually has been meeting with a lot of the protesters about their demands and have been trying to find ways to kind of meet halfway, so to speak. One of the protesters, Barbara Himmel, is a homeless woman who really thinks the city is treating the homeless people unfairly in this effort to remove them from the park.
I honestly think they shouldn't remove people for standing up for what they believe in. That's basically telling me that they don't care about us when we're human just like they are.
All right. And as you spoke to some of the leaders, what did they say to you?
A lot of the leaders have actually been talking about ways to maybe make a lawsuit out of this if people are arrested because they say that it's unfair. But even beyond the leaders are people that aren't homeless that have kind of joined in on this movement. One of them is Jordan Welch, and he says that he is prepared to stick beside his family. He's calling a lot of these homeless people his family, and he's prepared to stick by them. If they get arrested, he's going to.
You want to kick people out of Bronson Park, kick me out as well, but I'm going to jail fighting for what my family believes in.
All right. Have you had a chance to talk with city officials or police, Bryce? How do they plan on getting people out of the park?
So I haven't had a chance to speak with police. They said they were going to give an official response to whether or not people are going to get arrested at 7 or what their plans are. And I'm probably going to go back in there in the next few minutes and see if they have a response ready.
Well, it certainly seems like people are digging in, and I know you'll be there tonight after 7 to cover what happens, Bryce?
Yes, I will be here regardless of if police arrest people or not, and hopefully get some answers from police at that time.
Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Bryce Huffman. Bryce, thank you.
Thank you.
The only emergency overnight shelter in the city is the Kalamazoo Gospel Mission, which was founded in 1933. Pastor Michael Brown heads the Kalamazoo Gospel Mission. Pastor Brown, what are your thoughts on the weeks-long protest in Bronson Park?
Wow. You know, one of the things I think about it is that you've got two or three different groups that are taking a part in that. When we made our offer to allow the folk who were had been transferred over to Cedar Street to use a portion of land here behind the Gospel Mission, we had enough room for that group of people because it hadn't grown to what it's grown to now. And so the folk that came over here and are occupying our property right now, they have expressed a desire to be separated from the group downtown, and they've also expressed a desire for help. And so we've got case managers working with them. You know, but it just seems to me that because of the way the negotiations have gone or not gone, it seems as though that some requests just, some folks just won't be satisfied, period.
Well, why did the folks who are staying and at your area, why did they want to be separated from the group? When you say downtown, you mean the group in Bronson Park?
Yeah, they just feel that that group doesn't represent them, and they're there now. I mean, I wish sometime that the media would come over here and interview the different groups rather than just to interview the one.
Now, how do you think overall the city has responded to the challenge of homelessness and these charges from some of these homeless community activists that there's a lack of resources for them?
Well, I think there's plenty of resources. I think that people have an expectation of resources that give them what they want without them being invested at all. And so what I've seen, especially for people who come here that leave disgruntled, oftentimes they will come and they'll expect to get services that we don't provide, you know, or they'll come and expect to just be able to stay here without working on their situation or working with the case manager to help them get to that next step. You know, most of the people that we're talking about have income, but they would choose to spend their income on what they want and have somebody else to pay for what they need. And that never works out well.
You are the only emergency overnight shelter in the city. Are you able to handle all of the needs of Kalamazoo's homeless population?
You know, we're running our numbers right now. I just got off the phone with the city manager, and so we're going to take a look at what our capacity is right now. You know, the thing is, and what I don't understand, is how the group of homeless has grown over the last few days. You know, where did all of these people come from? Because, you know, in my estimation, many of them we had not seen until this, you know, hit the news. You know, now, should they leave the park downtown, one of the things we're going to be looking at for those that come here is, are they truly homeless or are they part of a demonstration? For those people who are actually homeless, we'll do everything we can to help them.
I'm speaking with Pastor Michael Brown, who heads the Kalamazoo Gospel Mission. And Pastor Brown, I'd like your thoughts on some of the grievances from the protesters. Some say that they feel unsafe, that they've been assaulted at your shelter. Is safety a problem at your shelter?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard some of those stories. It's funny because one of the guys who was talking said that he had been barred from our shelter for 13 years, which really caught me. But as we looked at our records, he was eating here, you know, even while he was saying that, and he was staying here off and on just prior to the demonstration. And so, you know, people will say what they want to say, and oftentimes people won't verify the information. You know, I've heard some people saying that they were assaulted here. You know, we do something about it when we know about it, but if they choose not to tell us about it, then there's nothing we can do about it. And then some people just don't want to be in an environment where there are a lot of other homeless people. But if that's where you are in your life and that is a temporary situation, well, then certainly it's going to be uncomfortable. But it's something you have to endure to get to where you want to go.
Pastor Brown, have you made any changes in how security is handled at the shelter since these protests began in August?
You know, actually, we've been reviewing our policies for over the last year because, as you may know, we will be building a larger shelter that will replace the old buildings. And so when we do that, we recognize that when our facilities change, that the way we operate may have to be adjusted. And so recently, because some of our staff had complained about men sleeping between cars out in the parking lot, people urinating around the building and things like that, we hired a security agency to walk the property in the evenings and try to help keep us safe. And usually when you get the number of people together that we have here, you will have people who will target that population. We've had people who are not staying here to come and talk to the ladies and tell them that they can get them, you know, a cheaper apartment or things like that. Or we've got an apartment for you, and let me take you and show it to you. And then the lady said that once they get over there in the apartment, the people will target them for sexual favors. And so when we find out something like that, we immediately contact the police and give them descriptions, you know, of things like that, because we want to keep our people safe.
Pastor Brown, how do you envision all of this being resolved?
You know, I think one thing that keeps it going is the attention that it gets, especially when you have people who are not willing to take advantage of the services that are already available. The thing that's encouraging to me was the group that came over early on and said, look, we need help. You know, I believe people have an innate desire within themselves to take care of themselves. If you recall, years ago, you would see a homeless person on the corner and their sign would say, we'll work for food. That's because it was something inside of them that said, I need to take care of myself. And if you're going to help me, then I need to give something back. And so my hope is that as people come to us, at least, that we can help to redevelop the want to inside of them and show them that they do have a certain amount of power. They do have options to change their situation. But you can't change your situation until you change the way you think. And sometimes people have thought the way that they think for so long, it's really a challenge to get them to see that they deserve anything different.
Pastor Michael Brown is the head of the Kalamazoo Gospel Mission. Pastor Brown, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you, Cindy. Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
Still to come, Libertarian candidate for Governor Bill Gelinno unveils a plan called My Way Forward.
You know, I call this my Nixon goes to China moment. Only a Libertarian could propose that we actually give money to people to do a good thing.
We'll hear what that plan entails in 20 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to talk about Detroit's music scene. Paul Young is back with us, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine. And Paul, today you're going to walk us through the musical path set by a couple of artists that who are longtime staples of Detroit's electronic and art music scene.
That's right. They go by the moniker Adult, and that is all caps with a period at the end.
Okay. Very specific then.
That's right.
So who are they?
So they're actually a husband and wife duo. It's Adam Lee Miller and Nicola Cooperus. And they've been making music together since, I think, in the 90s, but they officially came out as Adult, like early 2000s.
All right. And so, in fact, somebody who knows their music said, oh, yeah, and they used to be called, Plasma Company?
Plasma Company, that's right. They began work together in about 1998, and they released this really obscure 12-inch single called Modern Romantics. And Adult released a lot of their stuff before they started officially releasing music as Adult on 12-inch vinyl singles. And so actually their first album that we're going to talk a little bit about today was really just a recollection of a lot of previously recorded work.
And that first formal release was Resuscitation. Let's listen to a track from that 2001 release. This is Hand to Fall.
You're on the phone, you're all alone. Hand to phone, hand to phone.
So, Paul, what was new and different here for that time? Where did adult fit in?
Yeah, so, like, if you can imagine, this is 2001. Dempth just popped up on the scene. That's Detroit Electronic Music Festival, now known as Movement. But they had a really awesome set there in the inaugural year of that festival, and that kind of put them on the map. But they're one of the first to really embrace not only kind of the old regime of Detroit techno, but also infusing it with a lot of industrial sounds, a lot of punk sounds, and they really created this new kind of lane. But Resuscitation was their debut album, but it, like I was saying earlier, it's a lot of re-released tracks. It was 5 remixed songs and 4 digitally remastered tracks, and that was from a lot of their past work, like Dispassionate Furniture EP, the Entertainment EP, New Phonies EP, and it was really just their introduction formally to adults' aesthetic. Miller is a really serious photographer, and you see on a lot of the album covers this very specific photography style, and that was the introduction to kind of the whole package of adult.
And were there other people involved in making music with them?
Yeah, so later on, they go from a duo to a trio. It's very short-lived, but right before their the next album we're going to talk about, Why Bother, was their return to that duo form. But they did have a guitarist named Sam Consiglio join them, and that was right around the time of their Doom EP, and it did bring a new sound. But by the time of 2001, when Hand to Phone was being released, this is like right around the time that the Marshall Mathers EP is catching on fire. Another Detroit artist who's celebrating their 20 years of success. But it was an interesting time in Detroit music, and there was certainly like a post-punk vibe going on. There was a big electronic resurgence happening, and they came around at the right time.
All right, let's move up to 2007, and this is Don't Worry Enough from 2007's Why Bother? Okay, so there's some experimentation going on here. How did this sound evolve?
Why Bother is much more radical. Like we were talking about earlier, Sam Consiglio came on. He added a lot of, they really leaned into that guitar aesthetic, that rock sound. And so the pendulum really swung back the other way. And Why Bother was much more radical. It was darker, and it really married this like dance, these two themes, which is dance and punk. And it's just a really interesting product.
All right, and their 7th studio album, This Behavior, was released this month. Let's check out a track called Perversions of Humankind. All right, Paul, how have you heard Adult evolve now that we're listening to their newest material?
Yeah, so they actually took a pretty lengthy break from recording, and they went on to do a couple other things, some visual art products. They made a 3-part horror series called The Three Graces Triptych, and they revamped this old commercial building in Detroit. So they took kind of a break, and in 2012 they returned with The Way Things Fall Apart, and that's a ghostly release. They also did this project called Detroit House Guests. They received a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and they were able to host these guests basically in their home for like weeks at a time to record and work and live. And then they also released a live album through Third Man Records. They recorded that at the Tennessee location of Jack White's Third Man Records and released that. So this behavior is like long-awaited. It's celebrating their 20th anniversary, as we talked about a little earlier, but it was also recorded and produced in a cabin in northern Michigan. They had this live setup, and they did it all there. And I would argue you can really hear kind of that. You can hear the cabin fever kind of setting in. There's a lot of sharp beats, intense vocals, and yeah, it's an awesome addition to their already legendary catalog.
And do they do much collaboration?
Yeah, so I mean, that Detroit House Guest was certainly a huge collaboration project, but they're very well known to remix other artists' work and to hop on and kind of collaborate with others, sure.
Now, how well known is Adult outside of the Detroit area? Do they have any kind of a national or international following?
That's a great question, and you know, a lot like some of our other legends of the electronic Detroit scene, you know, they're super well known internationally, and there's a lot of appeal, especially in Europe, for that Detroit techno sound. So I think Detroit is now in a place where it's recognizing how lucky it is to have such a great, vibrant music history, and really embracing electronic music, as you've seen with kind of just the evolution of the Movement Festival. But I think Adult is long overdue to get their recognition as a really awesome electro-punk influential group that has done so much for the Detroit music scene.
And again, we've been talking about the husband and wife duo of Adult. And as Paul pointed out, it's A-D-U-L-T, period, all caps. Got to make sure we get that right. Paul Young, founder, publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. MDOT's flex route that runs along 9 miles of U.S. 23 north of Ann Arbor is winning praise from outside Michigan. The U.S. 23 flex route has won a regional award. It's now up for a national award. Let's talk more about this unique highway project and whether we could see it replicated elsewhere in the state as we say hello to Jeff Cranson with the Michigan Department of Transportation. Jeff, good to have you with us.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
So let's get everybody who's listening all around the state who perhaps never has set foot on US 23, just what the flex route is, because this is the first one in Michigan, isn't it?
It is. It's in the trade. It's actually called active traffic management, which means it's a way of managing traffic. We didn't want this to be called ATM because that conjures other things, obviously.
It does.
So,
it does.
So we came up with a name unique to Michigan, flex route, and we hope that brand can be useful other places where now that we know this is a success, maybe there's other places in the state this could be used. It's a environmentally much safer, less expensive way to add extra capacity without actually having to add a lane. It would have cost probably four times as much as the $120 million it cost to make a shoulder available certain times of the day. So basically, the flex route allows you to use the shoulder during peak traffic times. So in the morning, obviously, that's when people are coming into Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. In the afternoon, that's when people are leaving Ann Arbor.
Well, I'm going to be full confession here. I drive it every single day.
Yeah.
And I've watched this since we had it available in November. So I know as I'm driving to Ann Arbor in the morning and out of Ann Arbor, that at that peak time, there's a gantry overhead, and there is an arrow pointing to that left shoulder, and there's either an X, red X for do not drive, or a green arrow that says feel free to drive. So that's not a full regular lane on that left side?
Right, and it can't be. The Federal Highway Administration wouldn't allow that. You still need a shoulder most of the time, you know, for safety reasons, for cars to pull off, and that's why there are designated pull-off spots if you do have car trouble. I'm sure you've seen those.
Yes.
As you go by. But yeah, that's the reason. They allow it as long as it's used, you know, just for peak times to help capacity, what the people in the trade call operations, which I know seems unusual to us because we feel like we're the operators of the car, but they're talking about operating the system. You know, it's a lot of people spend a lot of time at MDOT and other departments, transportation around the country, trying to figure out how to ease your commute, how to limit your delays, because the time stuck in traffic is lost time. It's lost money for all of us.
Yes.
So this was a method they came up with to say, let's alleviate one of the biggest pinch points in the state, basically. Some of the highest congestion was on US 23 north of Ann Arbor. And it's largely done that. It's worked better, I think, than a lot of people's wildest dreams in terms of what it's done to eliminate that congestion. I mean, you see it yourself.
Yeah. So in essence, it's almost like that steam valve I remember on my mother's pressure cooker. So when the steam gets heavy, meaning at the peak times, you can turn on that valve and
that's a good metaphor. Yeah, that's what it does. It releases that at the peak times. And you know, people still ask, obviously, why can't I use it all the time? And as I explained, because the Federal Highway Administration would say, no, you still need a shoulder most of the time. You just, we're going to allow you to use it.
And I ask, why can't we have it everywhere?
Yeah, why can't we have it everywhere? And maybe 96 in western Oakland County would be a candidate. I think there's some spots around Grand Rapids that could be good candidates, maybe on US 131. And I think there's other places in the state now that we know this works and that people have adapted to it very well. I think that you're going to see this application be available at places, and it's a great idea because long term we don't know what we're going to need in terms of capacity. You know, with automated vehicles coming, you know, if people could be driverless cars, could be we have more on the road because it allows more people mobility, but it could be fewer because you're tightening up the spaces and all the things that make for inefficient traffic flow. So ultimately, you don't need as much capacity, and certainly you maybe don't need the lane widths. So right now would be an odd time to be spending a lot of money to add capacity anyway. And, you know, we're becoming a more multimodal state, right? There's still people that want to do commuter rail, and there's still people that want to do, you know, BRTs. And, you know, the RTA in Southeast Michigan could lead to better busing someday.
Yeah. Someday, yes.
So do we need to add capacity, which is very expensive and is an environmental challenge, you know, to take lanes and worry about endangered species, both plants and animals and those things. So this was a way to use what was the existing footprint.
That's what I wanted to be
capacity.
Clear. So that was the existing footprint, but just it's reconfigured.
Yes, exactly.
With this kind of interesting regulation size shoulder that we can drive on for these certain
and periods. And it's all the things that we all wrestle with, right? Because we all look in the mirror and see an environment. And we'd all like to think that we're doing the right thing, but we're still a state that was built to get wherever we want to get, you know, in 20 minutes or an hour or whatever you think your commute is, you think it should always be that. And those are the conveniences that we expect.
Was it faster doing that kind of?
Yes, absolutely.
It
would have been a long environmental process and a long process of buying right of way and building another lane. Yeah, that would have taken a lot longer.
So can people listening other, you know, you mentioned west side of Michigan. We've got people living in the Thumb area who are listening and northern Michigan. So is it safe to say everyone at MDOT is pleased enough with how the US 23 Flex lanes have performed that we could see them elsewhere?
Yeah, I definitely can't promise where the next one will be and that it'll be tomorrow, but it's definitely a model that should be emulated. They've done it in some other states with some success, and we weren't sure how it would work here, and it's worked very well.
What was it about US 23 that made MDOT go, this is the spot?
You know, I think it's kind of innovative thinking of some of the engineers here in what is called the university region and the people that are looking at the pinch points and what they could do. I mean they're on a real roll, the folks in this area out of the Brighton Transportation Service Center. I mean, first they did the 9623 reconfiguration, which, you know, has also worked great and alleviated a lot of safety concerns when you were merging and changing from one freeway to the other. And then right on the heels of that, they completed this project. And I think it was just looking at various pinch points and creative solutions, and that was one where they thought this could work.
And what have the numbers told you as far as how well it's worked? Is it something you can measure and something that there's a metric for?
There is, and I haven't seen the most recent numbers, but the biggest measure is that you're not seeing the backups that you used to see. So the actual percentages are out there, and there's reports actually that are going to be coming out very soon that prescribe really hard numbers on that.
I know the route is one of 12 finalists in the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials America's Transportation Awards. Is this kind of like the Emmys or the Oscars for road projects?
Well, it sort of is, except in this case, there's a people's choice element to it. And, you know, some states that are bigger have done better in these contests before than we have in Michigan. And so that's why I really kind of want to encourage people, if you like it, if you drive it, vote. And you can do that. You can get on our website. It's actually America's Transportation Awards, but you can go to michigan.gov/MDOT and you'll see it right there on the homepage and a chance that you can vote. And you can vote more than once. Every 24 hours, you're allowed to vote. So if you really like it and you want to do something good for Michigan, you know, this makes us look good in terms of innovation. And I'm thinking the social media engagement in the Ann Arbor area, where this is very popular, it could be helpful. And maybe we can catch Florida and some of the bigger states that always seem to do so well in these contests.
Overall, how do you think this U.S. 23 flex route process, how has it changed the way Michigan might think of solving safety issues and road congestion?
I think that's just it. I think we have to think very innovatively. I think the diverging diamond interchanges, which we've done two of now in the state, you're probably familiar with the one in Auburn Hills at University Drive and I-75, that kind of thing. At first seems a little counterintuitive to people, but once you drive through it, you think, wow, this is great. Yeah. Traffic flows. It's much safer. So there's just all kinds of innovations. You know, we've done the bridge slides where they build a bridge right next to the existing one, and then overnight they basically demolish one and slide one into place. It's kind of the good and the bad of having this long-term funding challenge in Michigan, you know, that we've underfunded infrastructure. So, you know, necessity, invention. So these people get innovative and think, what can we do with the money we have? And then you're victims of your own success, right? Because if you can keep doing these things, then maybe you don't need more money. But I can tell you that the state definitely needs to spend more on transportation.
All right, so people can go to the MDOT website if they want to express their pleasure and put in a vote.
Yeah, put in a vote. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Jeff Cranson, Michigan Department of Transportation, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The winners of America's Best Transportation Projects will be announced this Sunday, September 23rd. Voting closes at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday, the 22nd. And Cranson did get back with numbers. He said, in general, for southbound 23 in the morning, they're seeing a 56% improvement in planning time, which is a measure of the reliability or dependability of the system. So basically, the time you need to give yourself for a trip if you need to be at your destination on time. For northbound during the afternoon peak, that number is 27% improvement in planning time. This is Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we head toward the midterm elections in November, we're having a series of short conversations with statewide candidates to drill down on a single issue. This time, Medicaid and the Healthy Michigan Plan. Last week, we heard what Republican Bill Schuette and Democrat Gretchen Whitmer had to say on the topic. With us now, the Libertarian gubernatorial candidate, Bill Gelineau. Bill, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad I could be here.
The Trump administration has made it such a top priority to end the Affordable Care Act. What is your position on that?
Well, you know, I've said in the past that I would not have designed it the way it is, but I think that the energy and efforts that made it come about in the first place certainly have purposes. Unfortunately, we've spent an awful lot of time on who's going to pay for it rather than the actual cost drivers. What is the behaviors or what are the things that we could change that would make healthcare less expensive in the first place?
And certainly Healthy Michigan is the expansion of Medicaid in our state that happened under the ACA. We've got some 650,000 people, more than that actually, enrolled. And Governor Snyder is asking the federal government for a waiver to allow the state to implement a work requirement for able-bodied adults who get coverage through Healthy Michigan. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's an ill-conceived addition. I supported Governor Snyder's original idea here, which was to expand and make sure that people are getting that primary coverage. I think it's really vital. But I think that this effort by the Republican Party in particular to take away coverage when people are unable to work, I think it's just ill-conceived.
So what changes would you like to see made with Healthy Michigan if you become governor?
Probably the biggest one is I'd like to have us address what are called certificates of need. This is really a cost driver in the system that hasn't been looked at very much, and that is a board having to approve certain types of equipment, and it really drives up costs by driving out competition. And so that is probably the first thing that we would want to try to address. And then further, you know, we want to talk about Medicaid when we can.
Yes, well, let's go ahead and talk about Medicaid, and you've got a program that you are taking the wraps off today.
I am, and it is something that I think folks may not know, that over 40% of the children born in Michigan each year have been born and paid for by the Medicaid system. So we are unwrapping on our website, which is cometogethermichigan.org, a program that we're calling My Way Forward, MI Way Forward, or 23 for Me, where we're going to provide actual direct payments to young girls who are willing to commit themselves to a plan year by year to hold off having children until they're 23 years of age, where they're going to be in a better position to be a successful parent.
And where would that subsidy money come from?
my initial thought here is to run what's called a waiver program with the Medicare system out of Title 42, which is the payment structure from the federal government. And our idea is to do a pilot 5,000-person plan to see if we can actually encourage this positive behavior. We think there's three really good reasons to do this. Number one is it's been shown with much social science that girls who have babies when they're still teenagers or very young 20s have a much greater likelihood of having difficulty and moving forward and being caught in the social welfare net. We want to encourage them to increase their education and to be simply more mature. The second thing is that a program like this, we believe, is going to reduce long-term expenses in Medicare, Medicaid, and other social welfare programs. And the third thing that I think is the most important is we really believe that we are the social justice warriors in this race. There are so many government programs that support middle and upper middle class people. One quick example is the subsidies that go to universities on a per student basis, $5,500 last year. And that kind of money obviously helps support people that are more often coming from good socioeconomic backgrounds rather than those that struggle to even get into college in the first place.
How much are you proposing that young women would be paid for every year she doesn't have a child?
Well, it's actually a sliding scale, starting at $2,000 during that first year and then moving all the way up to the final year. And they're 23 years old, they're going to get $7,000. It actually is a $27,000 program for someone who completes the program. And there's additional benefits that involve Michigan income tax credits. We want to make it, we want to say really strongly that we're not trying to get rid of the poor. We're trying to give people an opportunity to move forward. And they would get these additional benefits only if they stayed in Michigan. You know, one of the concerns we have about education now is young people graduating and moving out of the state. This is our way of saying we'd like you to stay. And the final benefit is an automatic qualification with MISHTA for down payment assistance on a home.
Okay. So you really want to make this something that can launch them into adulthood?
Absolutely. And I just think so many of our programs are targeted with, you know, behavior-related goodness. But unfortunately, a lot of folks that are in poverty are not able to access those programs. I think this is something where, you know, I call this my Nixon goes to China moment. Only a libertarian could propose that we actually give money to people to do a good thing. And I don't shy away from the fact that as a libertarian, you know, I don't believe that my social engineering is more beneficial than Republican or Democratic social engineering, except that we believe this will work.
I want to shift over. ACA critics, including your opponent Bill Schuette, say they believe the federal government will eventually withdraw support, i.e. dollars, for Healthy Michigan, for the Medicaid expansion. He believes Michigan's taxpayers will ultimately be on the hook for the entire bill. How concerned are you about that?
Well, I think there's some legitimate discussion to be had on that. You know, it's typical that these programs are kind of done with carrots and sticks. And I think what's most important is that we focus on actual costs. This is the same conversation we have when we're talking about auto insurance. Too often we pick up on who's just going to pay the bill, as opposed to what can we do to bend the curve to actually be more healthy or to have less cost in the system. And so I think what we would like to see proposed is a lot of different ideas that would encourage positive behavior. And that in and of itself helps ensure that these programs that are funded by the federal government don't need to have as much money in them.
And finally, as you're out on the campaign trail, Bill Gelinow, what are you hearing? Where do you think health care and health insurance rank in voters' concerns?
I think it's really high. When I've talked to groups, and I've talked to hundreds of them, I hear a lot about their access to that, and it certainly has provided me some unique perspectives. I think we need to do a lot more listening to each other, and as I've gone and done that, I've been very pleased to find out that maybe there's some things that I hadn't thought about, and so I'm using that to learn and to become the best candidate I can.
Bill Gelinow, Libertarian candidate for the governor of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Glad I could be here. Thank you.
It is time to talk our state's history. We're doing a special Michigan history segment today, marking the 100th anniversary of the deadliest flu outbreak in the history of our state, our nation, potentially the world, with 50 million deaths worldwide. It was known as the Spanish flu, and it spread across the globe near the conclusion of World War I and first showed itself in Michigan 100 years ago this week. With us now, State Archivist Mark Harvey with the Michigan History Center and medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor, Dr. Howard Markell. Dr. Markell, give us some background. Do we know how this flu that just ravaged populations around the world, how it actually started and where it started? Was it Spain, like the name implies?
Well, it's the popular conception, but we really don't know. You know, it's really a parlor game of where an epidemic or pandemic started. Unless the microbe announces itself, you know, I'm here, we really don't know. And there are many other places that have been hypothesized as the beginning of it. What we do know is that it was an H1N1 variant of flu and that very few people had immune experience with this flu. So it was particularly virulent, especially for people 15 to 45 years of age. So it rapidly traveled not only around the country, but around the world, as flu does. And it killed more people than any flu epidemic or pandemic that we know of.
When we think of things spreading today, when we're talking 2018, we think of how easily things can spread because of air travel.
Right.
How did it spread so quickly without that factor present?
Well, there was still steamship travel. And then there's a very interesting occurrence in 1918. It's called World War I. And so you had soldiers cheek by jowl in trenches and in barracks in the European theater. And, of course, in America, you had young men mobilizing to go to war, and they were in various camps that were outside major cities around the country, and then traveling by train and then steamship to Europe. So that was quite a vector. And then you just have regular travel, train travel, automobile travel, and people coughing and sneezing on one another. It's simple as that.
So did medical experts at the time have any idea what they were dealing with?
Well, they knew it was flu, influenza.
Influenza.
You know, influenza is really what it is. Everyone uses the word flu for a cold, and that's not the case. Real influenza makes you sick as a dog. It is has real components of coughing, sneezing, chest pain, muscle pain, high fevers, and even delirium. They knew it was influenza, but they knew very little about viruses. They were just learning about bacteria. So they didn't know how to handle it other than basic nursing care, taking care of people in bed and so on, giving them fluids by mouth, not IV, that did not exist yet, and basically nursing them back to health. But they had no real vaccines or antivirals or any medications of any sort. In fact, most people who died didn't die of flu per se. They died of bacterial pneumonia, which was a secondary complication to having the flu, influenza.
Mark, do we know exactly when and where the Spanish flu arrived in Michigan?
We have a good sense of it, but again, records at this time weren't great. One of the earliest records I saw or mentions of it was actually 100 years ago to this day. Detroit Health Commissioner James Inches was warning Detroiters that this was going to be coming to Detroit. So a couple days later at a naval base downriver, there were the first reported cases, and then it just ballooned after that.
So that was my next question. Did it spread quickly across Michigan?
Yeah, I think it spread across the country within a week or two. There were cases reported all over the country. So again, how quickly did it spread across the state? Probably days or weeks into the UP. There's so many wide-ranging reports of this flu in the UP. It's hard to tell. Quickly, in short.
Right, right. And Dr. Markell, how did people know if they were sick and how quick were their typical symptoms and how quickly could it kill?
Well, it did spread rather rapidly. It probably September 20th. It actually was at a naval base right outside of the River Rouge plant of the Ford factory. But as I was saying earlier, influenza is not a common cold. You are really very ill. And so while there were no cultures, viral cultures, to prove that it was flu, these were really would be called today influenza-like illnesses, the fact that they were so sick with respiratory symptoms, the levels of fever, I mean, high fevers, 104 or higher, very bad muscle aches throughout the body, and even delirium from the fever, that you would know is different than a common cold. So they made their best guesses in terms of their diagnoses, and given that it was a pandemic, they were probably right most of the time.
And would people be gone within mere days of first feeling symptoms?
They could. They could. Traditionally, it's babies and very old people who die of influenza for various reasons of their immune system and their respiratory tracts. But they could die within a few days, or they could get bacterial pneumonia and die within a week or so. You know, there's a great line by Victor Vaughn, who was the dean of the medical school at the University of Michigan at the time, but he was enlisted to help with the flu epidemic. And he said, bodies were being stacked like cordwood. And that shows you how many people were dying and how rapidly they were dying.
Mark, do we know how individual communities responded? I'm wondering, did some areas get quarantined, or did some towns say nobody from the outside can come in?
Well, the state actually jumped in and finally ordered statewide closures for various businesses and public places and really singled out places that they felt there could be easy transmission of the disease. One paper reported that the Sunday that this closure order went into effect was the bluest, quote-unquote bluest, of all blue Sundays, referring to the blue laws that didn't allow you to do certain things on Sundays. And then they even passed a law that quarantined homes that had individuals that had influenza, and if they broke that quarantine, they were punished with a $100 fine or up to 90 days in jail.
How did all of this come to an end, and how long did this pandemic run?
Well, the pandemic, like most flu pandemics, just burned itself out. But there was not just the 1918 influenza pandemic. It extended well into April of 1919. And then we don't talk about this much. There was another wave of flu in the winter of 1920, January through April of 1920. Mm. And by spring, it seemed to die out in 1919. But, you know, Michigan and Michigan cities didn't have a good record of imposing these so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions, quarantine, school closure, public gathering bans early enough. And a study that we did at the Center for the History of Medicine at U of M with the CDC found that you had to do all of these interventions early before flu spread out all over your community. You had to do more than one and to layer them, so to speak, and you had to do it for a long period of time. Most communities started way too late and did them in a haphazard way, which had all the social, not benefits, but the lacking of benefits. You know, they're really disruptive, but none of the benefits by doing them early and long enough. Detroit had one of the worst records in the United States. Grand Rapids, on the other hand, which imposed these interventions early and for a long period of time, had one of the best records in terms of mortality from influenza that year.
How did that result in death toll in Michigan?
Well, the death toll is quite high. We don't have good records, but if we use the average case fatality rate around the country and apply it to the number of cases that we know occurred in Michigan, probably about 19,000 Michiganders died of flu that year.
When we realize that there were 50 million deaths worldwide from Spanish influenza, where does that put it if you were ranking awful pandemics to strike the world?
Some of those numbers go even as high as 100 million deaths worldwide.
So
it's
million.
The great mother of all pandemics, to misquote Saddam Hussein.
Okay.
It was the worst
that
we know of.
Oh, boy, that is something. And if we had this kind of influenza outbreak today, would Michigan be ready?
Yes and no. We have much better hospital systems and intensive care units and medicines in our armamentarium. Our public health department is very qualified, but their budgets have been cut ridiculously low levels, most people would say, over the years. So it would be a challenge. And the other challenge is, how would the population at large respond? And a big thing to remember is that if you are sick, stay home. Don't tough it out and go to work, because you'll infect others. So that's important for people to know as well.
Lessons to be learned. And for anyone who wants to dig more deeply into the history of Spanish flu, Spanish influenza, Howard, you and your colleagues compiled a lot of data for us to review on a website. So what'd you compile?
Yeah.
What's the site?
Well, it's called the 1918, 1919 Digital Influenza Encyclopedia. It has all things influenza in the United States during that year, newspaper clippings, documents, basically the biographies, if you will, of 50 or more cities we keep adding to it in the United States, how they responded, who was mayor, what they did, all the scandals, all the inside dope, so to speak. And you can go to influenzaarchives.org. And you will be occupied, I guarantee you, for hours on end.
Dr. Howard Markell, PBS contributor and medical historian with the University of Michigan, and Mark Harvey, Michigan History Center, state archivist. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.